Come Again, Sexuality and Orgasm is my solution-driven limited series podcast to get your libido to kick in and your clitoral nerve endings to wake up. You can find Come Again on drstriker.substack.com. I was invited to participate in last week's Food and Drug Administration's Roundtable on Menopausal Hormone Therapy. I declined. In this episode, I'm going to tell you why. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, a gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause, midlife, and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. A few weeks ago, I received an invitation on behalf of FDA Commissioner Dr. Marty Makary to participate in a public roundtable titled Menopause and Hormone Replacement Therapy. The invitation explained that the media would be in attendance and the public was encouraged to watch via a live stream. While the invitation did not specifically say the purpose of the meeting, the word through my menopause grapevine was that the agenda was to finally remove the outdated and inappropriate warning mandated by the FDA that currently appears on all local vaginal estrogen products. This is a good thing, a really good thing. The science is solid. Local vaginal estrogen is safe for everyone, including women with breast cancer. But you wouldn't know it from reading the FDA-required black box warning on the package insert that practically has a skull and crossbones on it, causing you to consider if it's worth getting breast cancer, dementia, heart disease, or a stroke just to have pain-free sex and a bladder that functions properly. Except nothing written on that warning is true. And there is no need to update your will before you start to treat your vaginal dryness and overactive bladder. So why is it there? Well, I need to give you some background, and then I'll explain why I ultimately declined to participate in the roundtable. To do that, I'm going to start with a quick history of the FDA, the role of the FDA today, and then get into the specifics of the black box warnings on estrogen products, why they need to be changed, what, from my point of view, the FDA should be doing, and then what actually happened at that FDA event. So let's start with the fact that drug approval is an extensive and exorbitantly expensive process that prevents many drugs, including good drugs, from getting to the public. On average, the timeline from when a drug is first developed to being available is 12 to 15 years and costs in the neighborhood of $1 to $2 billion. Most drugs never reach the pharmacy. But as flawed as the current FDA is, things are much better than before it existed. So I want to mention that what I'm about to tell you about the history of the FDA is straight from a Substack article I wrote a few months ago. The link is in the program notes if you'd like to see the pictures that go with it and more on some of the current issues at the FDA. All right, so the initial Food and Drugs Act, passed by Congress in 1906 and signed by President Theodore Roosevelt, was to control interstate commerce of misbranded and adulterated foods, drinks, and drugs. Unlike today, there were no requirements to establish the safety or efficacy of drugs and other products. Back then, the label did not have to list ingredients, which meant that consumers had no way of knowing if the product they were using contained alcohol, heroin, cocaine, morphine, or opium, which at that time were commonly used in medicine. Clinical trials did not exist. There were no studies in which people would take a new drug and compare it to people taking a placebo drug to prove that it worked and that it was safe. New drugs were released to the public by the manufacturer based on their claims that that drug would treat an illness or a condition, which sounds a lot like what currently happens in the over-the-counter and compounding world. There was some informal testing, but it was pretty random. It wasn't unusual for physicians to try a new drug on themselves first to make sure nothing bad happened. No surprise, with minimal or haphazard testing before selling a new drug, bad things did happen. In 1912, Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup to calm teething babies was extremely popular. Unfortunately, the active ingredients, morphine and alcohol, made it a little too soothing, resulting in thousands of deaths. Children went to sleep and never woke up. It took years to determine that, quote, the mother's friend was what was killing their babies. That disaster prompted the passage of the Shirley Amendment, which prohibited labeling medicines with intentionally false claims. Again, at this time, no testing or proof of efficacy was required before the release of a product. In 1937, another disaster occurred. A popular sulfa antibiotic, elixir sulfenamide, laced with diethylene glycol, otherwise known as antifreeze, killed over 100 people, including many children. And then there was Lashler, an eyebrow and lash dye that, in a major oops, dissolved corneas and blinded over a dozen women. Those that were not blinded developed horrific blisters and ulcers on the face, eyelids, and eyes. One woman developed a bacterial infection and died. Those kinds of disasters prompted the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938, which required new drugs to be approved before marketing. This was the beginning of the modern FDA. For the first time, drugs had to be tested before they were brought to the public to make sure they were safe. In addition, and this was big, drugs had to be labeled with specific directions. We take for granted that when we get a prescription, it's going to tell us how much to take and how often to take it. But before 1938, those kinds of directions did not exist. This was also the beginning of requiring a prescription for drugs. Prior to 1938, people could walk into the corner's drugstore and request any medication they wanted. Now we have to go to Mexico to do that. Notice I didn't say anything about a drug proving that it worked. At that point, FDA approval did not require that a drug was effective, only that it would not cause harm. It wasn't until 1962 that a drug had to establish efficacy through clinical trials to gain FDA approval. It's also important to note that then and now, the FDA doesn't conduct clinical trials. They just evaluate external clinical trials, either done by a pharmaceutical company or through government grants. The need to prove both efficacy and safety was a good thing and well-intentioned, but has become highly problematic. With the goal of protecting the public, the timeline and expense for approval is, again, why most drugs never get to the public. But as a result of the 1962 legislation, at least you know that if a drug is FDA approved to help hot flashes, it has demonstrated that it will do so, how well it's going to work, how much to take, and any possible side effects. And while the process has been slow and expensive and needs to be improved, new drugs are hitting the market all the time, which is why survival rates for cardiovascular disease and cancer continue to improve, even though there's more cardiovascular disease and cancer than ever before. Which brings me to the estrogen story. The first commercial estrogen to treat menopause symptoms was released in 1907. But things didn't really take off until Dr. Robert Wilson, the Suzanne Summers of the 1960s, wrote Feminine Forever, a book that promised a fountain of sexual, mental, and physical youth to women who treated the disease of menopause with Premarin. Dr. Wilson used words like flabby and desexed to describe menopausal women and promised that estrogen was a fountain of youth. This bestseller stated on its cover that, quote, every woman, regardless of age, can safely live a full sex life for her entire life, end quote. And even though the FDA had only approved Premarin specifically for the treatment of hot flashes and vaginal dryness, Feminine Forever promoted and promised that Premarin would keep women youthful, attractive, sexy, cheerful, and most important, able to hang on to their husbands. And they would only have themselves to blame if their husbands did stray. I know you'll not be shocked to hear that Feminine Forever was quietly funded by Wyeth, the company that made Premarin. It was truly a stroke of genius, the equivalent of a pre-social media, viral, direct-to-consumer marketing campaign. The first bump in the estrogen road occurred in 1976, when it became apparent that women who took estrogen had a tenfold increased risk of developing uterine cancer compared to women who didn't take estrogen, resulting in the recommendation to take a progestogen with estrogen to protect the lining of the uterus. It was also the first time the FDA put a warning on the package that estrogen could cause cancer. Fast forward to the release of the WHI, the Women's Health Initiative. The WHI was not designed to determine if estrogen treated menopause symptoms, but determine if hormone therapy would prevent cardiovascular disease and other serious medical problems. I go through all the details of the WHI in other episodes, so I'm not going to get into it here, other than to mention that while there was an increased risk of breast cancer in the estrogen and progestogen group, the WHI was primarily discontinued because of the increased risk of stroke, myocardial infarction, and pulmonary embolism. And that was the beginning of the black box warning that was required on not just the oral conjugated estrogen that was used in the WHI, but all products containing estrogen. This is known as class labeling. FDA class labeling requires all products containing the same ingredient to have the same warning, even if the issue has never been demonstrated in that product. So every single product that contains estrogen has the cancer, blood clot, dementia warning. Here's the problem. While it's true that oral estrogens increase the risk of blood clots, systemic transdermal patches, creams, and gels do not. Yet they're required to have that warning anyways. And here's where I get into the whole current issue. Local estrogen products are used in the vagina or on the vulva to treat symptoms of genital urinary syndrome of menopause, such as dryness, discomfort, painful sex, and urinary symptoms like recurrent urinary infections and urinary urgency. Not one single complication listed on the package insert has ever been shown to result from using a local estrogen cream, ring, tablet, or suppository. On the contrary, there are multiple scientific studies that confirm that the use of local vaginal estrogen does not increase the risk of blood clots, cancer, dementia, or recurrence of breast cancer. Now, some vaginal estrogen is absorbed into the bloodstream, but the amount is minimal. Just to keep it in perspective, the amount of systemic absorption of estrogen in a full year of using a local vaginal estrogen is roughly the same as if you took one birth control tablet a year. Blood levels of women who use vaginal estrogen are no different than those of postmenopause women who don't use vaginal estrogen, which is why it's not surprising that local vaginal estrogen is safe to use even if you have breast cancer or a history of blood clots. The effects are local rather than systemic, so vaginal estrogen has no impact on your hot flashes, bones, insomnia, or mood. But because of this really scary label on all estrogen products, millions of women who would benefit from using topical estrogen products suffer needlessly from vulvar and vaginal discomfort, sexual pain, and urinary symptoms. And it's not an overstatement that postmenopause women can die of sepsis because of preventable urinary tract infections. My Substack post yesterday is a review of a recent study that compares rates of sepsis due to urinary tract infections in postmenopause women using a local vaginal estrogen compared to women who don't. And spoiler alert, women who use a local vaginal estrogen are less likely to get sepsis and die. So for all of these reasons, for years, academic menopause experts, including myself, have lobbied to remove the dire warnings stating that the use of a local vaginal estrogen will increase the risk of breast cancer, heart attack, stroke, blood clots, uterine cancer, and dementia. In 2016, as an example, the North American Menopause Society filed a petition with the FDA to remove the black box warning that appears on the front of low-dose estrogen products. 2 years later, the FDA rejected the petition, citing the absence of, quote, studies that proved low-dose topical estrogen poses less risk to women than high-dose pills studied in the WHI, end quote. I'm on the advisory board of a menopause advocacy group, Let's Talk Menopause, which launched a campaign, Unboxing Menopause, with the mission of removing the outdated and misleading boxed warning label on local vaginal estrogen by having menopause experts send letters to the FDA and meeting with politicians to advocate for this change. So this is not a new thing, and it has been beyond frustrating. In the scientific and medical community, removal of these warnings is not controversial. It's settled science and the opinion of virtually every academic menopause expert that the use of a local vaginal estrogen does not cause any serious medical problems and be safely used by virtually all menopause women, including women with a breast cancer diagnosis. However, because of the terrifying misinformation on the label, healthcare professionals often do not offer prescriptions to women. And if someone is not a menopause expert, they rely on those FDA warnings and tell their patients that, well, you're not an appropriate candidate. And then even women who do fill a prescription then get home and read the label and decide the risk is just too great. So when a drug is up for FDA approval, or if a label change is being considered, the usual protocol is for the FDA to convene an external scientific advisory committee made up of experts who are familiar with clinical research methodologies, including statistical analysis, who maybe have published papers in this area of medicine or participated in the original clinical trials. In other words, experts who would be able to do a comprehensive review of updated data. Committees such as this meet behind closed doors and include scientists whose names you don't know, who spend hours, days, or weeks compiling data in order to reach a consensus opinion to present to the FDA scientists. The FDA then takes those recommendations into consideration and either agrees or disagrees. And then if there's a label change, then you have the big media event to announce the change and make sure that the public understands the change and how it will benefit them. So I assumed and was kind of honored that I was being invited to be part of a committee to get rid of the outdated vaginal estrogen boxed warning. And since other attempts to remove the label have been unsuccessful, I was hoping that the FDA process would be streamlined and updated so that it will finally happen. I attended the first informational Zoom meeting to learn more about the agenda. At this first meeting, it was made clear to all of us that this was not a scientific advisory committee, but a two-hour event streamed on YouTube in which various experts would present information to the media and to the public about the use of all forms of hormone therapy. The topics would include benefits and safety of local vaginal estrogen, systemic estrogens, and testosterone therapy, including the impact of women not taking hormone therapy. Each panelist would be given one slide and 5 minutes to speak, which is the equivalent of a segment on the Today Show, not a serious scientific committee. So I and many, but not all, felt pretty strongly that this initial discussion should be limited to local vaginal estrogen, for which there was a universal consensus about removal of the black box warning. Systemic estrogen is far more nuanced. Side effects and safety are dependent on many factors, such as whether it's oral or transdermal, conjugated estrogen versus estradiol, and lots of other things. While all of those systemic estrogen products would clearly benefit from modification of the label, it would be a far more complicated process. It also made no sense to me and others to include testosterone in the roundtable discussion. Testosterone is not FDA approved for use in women. FDA approval is an entirely different topic than modification of the black box warning on an approved existing product. My feeling was, let's keep it simple, one thing at a time. First, get the black box warning off the local vaginal estrogens and then move on to other products. Well, it soon became clear to me that that was not what was going to happen. All products would be discussed, and the discussion would include not only safety issues, but just a general overview of both local and systemic estrogen and testosterone therapy. I then asked if there was a plan to have a subsequent scientific advisory committee and was told there were no plans for that to happen. At that point, I bowed out. I let them know that I would be honored and thrilled to serve on a scientific advisory committee that reviews the safety data and then makes a recommendation to the FDA if that were ever to occur. I had multiple conversations with others, some of which, like me, decided to take a pass. Some experts, even though they were concerned about the format, decided to participate because they felt that the greater good was to get the label changed. The panel, which aired last week, I'll put the link in the program notes, as expected, had experts passionately explaining why women benefit from both local and systemic hormone therapy and why current warnings need to be removed. Most of the speakers were excellent and made the most of their limited time. It was quite impressive. Most of them presented valid scientific points for which little argument could be made. Others presented data information that was not settled science and still controversial in the menopause world. But to the average listener, I'm betting it was really confusing. Was the issue local vaginal estrogen, oral estrogen, transdermal estrogen? Which warnings need to be removed? Was it advisable to take estrogen to prevent dementia and heart disease? The messaging was all over the map. So, all right, today I'm not going to address the information about what conditions can be prevented or treated with estrogen, because as far as I'm concerned, that never should have been on the agenda. Local and systemic estrogen are FDA approved and available. If the goal was to remove or change the black box warning, which is all about safety, safety should have been the only thing addressed. Not why women might choose to take estrogen, but what are the risks of doing so. The whole thing was kind of strange. And the obvious question is, why have a media event and encourage the public to weigh in instead of a scientific advisory committee? Well, let's think about this. A media event is essentially a PR event that promotes and disseminates very specific messages. Message number one was the old, bad FDA couldn't get anything done, and the new FDA would. Dr. McCary commented reassuringly to each individual panelist, regardless of their topic, that he was going to do this. He was going to get this done. He would get the label removed from local vaginal estrogen. He would let women know that not only did estrogen not cause dementia, but that it would prevent dementia. He was going to quickly get testosterone FDA approved. It was like Santa Claus handing out presents at Christmas. Okay, I would agree that until now the FDA has fallen short, and that an FDA that's more efficient and streamlined would be a good thing. But that usually involves getting rid of unnecessary paperwork and barriers and speeding up the process by increasing staff, not firing over 3,000 staff members with years of expertise in regulatory science. And that doesn't mean that scientific advisory boards should be eliminated to save time. Message two was that this new administration cares about women. Removing the black box warning on local vaginal estrogen, removing breast cancer warnings on systemic estrogen, and making testosterone FDA approved are popular initiatives and would be a big win for women's health. Never mind that over 4,000 NIH grants have been defunded, including critical research in women's cancer, heart disease, and stroke. Never mind that the word woman must be eliminated in any research that gets federal funding. Never mind that hospitals and clinics that take care of women are closing because of defunding and anticipated Medicaid cuts. So, yes, doing something nice for women's health is a clever distraction to make up for all the ways women's health is being harmed. And some people suggested that I decline to participate in this panel because I didn't want there to be a political win for this FDA. No, that wasn't it at all. But the point is a label change should be a big win for women's health, not a win for the FDA. Which brings me to my major concern. With or without this panel, I suspect that Dr. McCary has already decided to change the label on hormone therapy without the benefit of convening a committee of experts to evaluate that change. As commissioner, he has the legal authority to do so and recently announced a new program to speed up approvals. The purpose of this panel was just to disseminate to the public at large what a good thing he was doing. And just as he can unilaterally decide to change the label on estrogen, he's setting a precedent to unilaterally decide to approve or revoke the FDA approval of other drugs such as testosterone. Which brings me to mefepristone. Mefepristone is the prescription drug that's been scientifically shown to safely and effectively terminate an early pregnancy without a surgical procedure. It was approved by the FDA in 2000 and has been a safety net for women who prefer medical abortion or who have no other options to legally terminate a pregnancy. But for those with a political agenda, it has falsely been claimed that mefepristone is dangerous, the complication rate high, and that FDA approval should be revoked. In April of this year, Dr. McCary stated he had no plans to change the current policy on mefepristone or to restrict access. On June 5th, he changed his message, stating that he would be reviewing the latest data on mefepristone. And just as the FDA commissioner can increase access to hormone therapy without the benefit of a scientific panel, the FDA commissioner can restrict access, grant, or revoke FDA approval of a drug. It's not an overstatement that we are looking at a scenario where the fate of mefepristone may be determined not by the convening of an impartial scientific committee, but by a public media event staffed by experts who present disinformation on mefepristone, followed by a unilateral decision on the part of the FDA commissioner. I may be wrong about all of this. I hope I'm wrong. I really hope I'm wrong. Just to be clear, do I think the black box warning needs to be removed from local vaginal estrogen products? Absolutely. Do I think the black box warning needs to be modified on individual systemic estrogen products? You bet. FDA warnings need to be updated to reflect current knowledge. But FDA mandates must be determined by a scientific committee that collectively reviews safety and efficacy data. Convening a media event and asking the public to sign petitions is not science, it's political PR. Politics should be completely removed from the process to ensure that all FDA decisions are based on solid science and expertise. This isn't just about hormone therapy or mefepristone. This is about how the FDA is going to address all drug approvals. And the big win would be to establish a new and more efficient process to ensure the safety and efficacy of all pharmaceuticals for all Americans, not to return to the early FDA days when drugs were distributed to the public without adequate safety and efficacy information. So that's the story. And every time I discuss politics, I get folks who contact me and say, stick to medicine. But today, politicians, not medical professionals, determine what kind of health care you have access to. And just so you know, my next episode about the history of the vibrator with the amazing Haley Lieberman is a lot lighter and a lot more fun, and will coincide with my Come Again episode on the science of why vibrators work so well.